Hey, I'm Jeff Cohen. Everything you hear on WNPR, from local news and talk shows to the national programs you love, is made possible because of listener support. You make it happen. You give the radio its signal, the computer its stream, the smartphone its podcast. You make it so we can reach you wherever you are. We love that you listen, but we also need your dollars. Go to WNPR.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for helping out.
From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative, and the nomination is confirmed.
Look, I hear you completely. And Sean Spicer's out there every day doing his press briefing. I'm happy to have the platform in CNN and other places to explain and to talk about what we're trying to do inside
the
White House.
Are we fake news, Kellyanne? Is CNN fake news?
No, I don't think CNN is fake news.
If President Trump continues on his announced courses of action in a wide range of areas, whether it's the environment or women's reproductive freedom or other forms of civil rights cases, gun safety laws, will probably be in court quite a bit.
They are mothers, daughters, sisters, fathers, sons, and brothers.
Mr. President.
They are.
Mr. President.
The majority leader.
The senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair.
He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth! What a comeback!
Not what a Steelers fan wants to hear early in the morning, but congratulations to all your Patriots fans out there. I'm John Dankosky. We're going to be talking about the week's news, and there's a lot of news to talk about this week with Colin McEnroe. As always, he's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Have you ever noticed how George Jepson always sounds like somebody might be trying to overhear this conversation? Isn't there some things going on right now that I might have to file some lawsuits about?
We saw him on CNN yesterday, and he was downstairs in our studios, so we decided
Jake,
to bring him
don't
upstairs.
Tell anybody this, okay? But
welcome, Colin. Welcome also to Susan Bigelow, columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello once again, Susan.
Good morning.
And Max Rees is here. He's political reporter at NBC Connecticut. Max, thanks so much for being here as well.
Good morning, John. Good to be here.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on the website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. It's budget day at the state capitol, so we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what we'll expect there coming up later. Strangely, we're not going to start today's program talking about something that Donald Trump said or did. Instead, we're going to talk about what happened in the Senate. The Senate chamber, where Majority Leader Mitch McConnell used a rule that only the U.S. Senate could come up with to silence debate by Democratic Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren as the group considers the nomination of Senate colleague Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General. There have been a lot of weird things, obviously, Colin, that have happened in the course of the last couple of weeks. This one seems enormously weird in its tone deafness to what's going on in America today. But I suppose that that Mitch McConnell hasn't always been able to carry a tune. What did you see in this silencing of the voice of Elizabeth Warren today?
Actually, I thought Mitch McConnell's first record was really good. And then after that,
it just all went downhill.
Yeah, the first CD, though, you should get it. So this non-impugnment, if that's a word, the non-impugnment rule, I've read it actually goes back to the debates over slavery. I'm not sure that's true. But it's certainly meant to keep debates themselves civil on the floor of the Senate so you don't have senators calling each other names. It seems ill-designed to apply to a debate on the merits of a nominee for a cabinet position, which is the way that it came up last night. In other words, how can you have a debate on the merits of a nominee for a cabinet position if there's a rule, if the person is a sitting senator and there's a rule saying you can't say anything bad about him, that means you can only have one side of that debate. It seems like a silly argument, except it's not silly. It's very important. Elizabeth Warren was trying to introduce some important information, including a letter from Coretta Scott King that was written at the time that his judicial nomination, Jeff Sessions' judicial nomination, was blocked. I think it is tone deaf. I think it's the kind of, you know, they keep doing the kinds of things that rile up the other base. And certainly when you have a woman trying to read a letter from a woman and all of that is silenced mainly by a group of men, right away you're getting 50% of the population really angry.
Yeah, and it's and again, this is a woman reading a letter from a woman who's sort of not just any woman, but this is Coretta Scott King. And so Elizabeth Warren silenced for reading a letter by someone else. I think for those of us, Colin, in this world of public radio where we talk an awful lot about our need to have a more civil discourse, I think it's great that there's a Senate rule about non-impugnment. But it seems as though what has happened in the last couple of days is we've got an attorney general nominee, Jeff Sessions, who is on one hand able to vote for the confirmation of Betsy DeVos one day and then able to not take part in a debate over his own nomination, but yet not be able to be impugned as though he was a sitting senator. It's a very odd confluence of things. I get it, but it just seems as though shutting up Elizabeth Warren might not be the thing that needs to come out of this at the end.
They've already got it set up so the House always wins. Not the House, like, as opposed to the Senate, but like the House as opposed to the casino. You know, the House is always going to win. So in some ways, it might make some sense. That's what I don't understand. Why not let Elizabeth Warren read this letter into the record? You're going to get what you want anyway.
That's right.
Sessions is going to be confirmed. Why do this? Why light that fuse when, in fact, you've already got the outcome you want? It takes a certain kind of crabbed mentality, I think, to, you know, to want to go there.
Well, it's also, this is sort of the question that we've been asking the past couple of weeks. Why do something that seems designed to inflame half the country? And it seems like they're doing it because it also inflames their own base. It also riles them up. And because they desperately dislike Elizabeth Warren, they're probably quite happy to see her be shut up. So this seems like this is kind of the motive of the Trump administration, Republican leaders in Congress. Sure, they're riling up the left, but they're also bringing their own supporters much more in line. So it's not a great thing, certainly, but maybe that's why.
I agree with Susan. I think that this will be a fundraising tool for Republicans in the U.S. Senate. Elizabeth Warren is akin to Ted Cruz as far as where they are on the ideological spectrum. The left despises Ted Cruz, to say nothing of Lindsey Graham talking about committing a homicide on the Senate floor. But Elizabeth Warren is somebody where they can fundraise off of and say, look, we shut up the liberal firebrand in the United States Senate. Look at how we did it. And it's going to get a lot of people excited. So I think that as much as there's going to be outrage on the left, there probably already is rejoicing on the right. I haven't checked much of Twitter this morning, but I'm sure it's there.
And Elizabeth Warren's poll numbers in Massachusetts are honestly not great. I saw a poll recently that said that, 44% said that she should be reelected, and 46% said that somebody else should get a chance. So, and as I believe that she's up for re-election this coming in 2018, so that's going to be something. Maybe they're looking at that.
And, yeah.
Sorry, John. And not to challenge too much, that also depends on who Democrats. I've seen the same poll numbers, by the way, Susan. It depends on who Democrats could put up against her, but also if it's Kurt Schilling that goes up against her on the right, then that's probably a slam dunk for Elizabeth Warren. I guess it would be a strikeout.
Right.
Or maybe a home run. Sorry.
I'm so glad I don't live in Massachusetts. Particularly the idea of a campaign featuring a bloody sock, you know, as if campaigns weren't horrific enough right now.
This took a turn quick.
Yeah. I know I don't want to see that campaign. Well, I mean, it was just suggested to me that one reason that they didn't want to read in the letter is it doesn't look that good if you read a letter like that and then you vote to confirm this guy. It's an old letter, it's about a different nomination. But, I mean, that may be the
but
other
reason
for
silencing. But it's not like the letter doesn't exist. This
right.
is the thing. It's not as though all these things aren't out there in the world.
What I have a question about in the United States Congress now, but also in our politics in general, is what things are and aren't, quote, off limits anymore. John Lewis boycotting not his first but his second presidential inauguration. Donald Trump disrespecting John Lewis. You can't read between the lines any other way. But now, but then also the Martin Luther King bust became an issue in the president's Oval Office. We have Coretta Scott King's letter now a problem on the United States Senate floor. These are things that I feel like 5, 6, maybe even only 2 or 3 years ago were kind of things that either you didn't talk about or you at least didn't talk about negatively. Maybe I'm off base with that.
No, I don't think you're off base at all. And that's been the story of the last couple of years, is the eroding of these particular norms. This is something I wrote about, but our democratic system, our entire system is kind of based on a sort of gentleman's agreement not to push these particular bounds, things that are not written down necessarily. But, you know, the whole point is that the government is composed of people who want to be able to pass that system on to the next generation. And if you have a bunch of people who do not care about that, all they want to do is punish the other side and get their own power, then these norms start to go away. So nothing is off limits anymore. I mean, you have the President of the United States out there tweeting this morning about his travel ban, saying that the judge, if the judges find against him, that they will be responsible if something happens, that it's their fault if there's an attack. And that's a thing that a couple of years ago was inconceivable, but now it seems almost normal.
Well, and let's actually turn to that, Colin. It's been the big news of the last couple of weeks, this travel ban pushed back by the courts. Now it's being considered in an appeals court in San Francisco. Trump has come out and called the judges, so-called judges. He, as Susan has said, has essentially put it at the feet of the court system, saying that if there's any danger that comes to Americans, it's going to be them. That is really something that we haven't heard in the past from a president.
Yeah, and I do think that it's all of a piece. I had a very disturbing conversation on Monday with a scholar named Yasha Munk, who is sort of looking at the fate of liberal democracies across the world right now. And look, if you want to tear the whole thing down, which is a kind of a phraseology that Steve Bannon, one of Donald Trump's closest advisors, has used in the past, this is what you do. You push hard against its institutions that have this kind of decided status within society. You try to undecide that status, whether it's the notion that John McCain's a war hero or that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff should be on the National Security Council, not your essentially political and media-grown advisor, Steve Bannon, or that a judge is a judge, not a so-called judge. And this is kind of a heart-in-mouth moment because it's coming very early in the Trump presidency. One of the fundamental questions is he's so inclined to disregard anything that flies in the face of what he wants to do, and he's so disinclined to read institutions as institutions. He reads institutions as pins that he needs to knock over with the bowling ball that is himself. This question of will he accept a court decision that he doesn't like? You know, will he? You know, the Supreme Court does not have battalions to enforce its decisions. Sometimes presidents have sent the National Guard to enforce a court decision. This is kind of the opposite. Is there any way to make a court decision stick if the president decides he just doesn't want to follow it?
And in this confusing world, Max, a lot of my reporters around New England have been following the travails of people trying to get in from overseas, students from Iran, families from Iraq. And this has put an awful lot of just really well-meaning civil servants who are trying to do their job, whether it's at the TSA or in the Justice Department, in an incredibly difficult position because from day to day, you don't know, the State Department as well, what sort of orders you're supposed to give people, what sort of paperwork you're supposed to sign, and whether or not you are on the side of the law as it's written.
To your point, John, there was an out-of-this-world editorial yesterday in the Baltimore Sun that talked about federal civil service employees, TSA workers, law enforcement going to work. They probably had breakfast with their families or they dropped their children off that day. And they were probably worrying about paying the rent or paying the mortgage or paying the utility bill. They go to work and one of them put in handcuffs a 6-year-old boy, if I'm not mistaken, or a 4-year-old boy. And another one. One of the reports was, though the Trump administration has denied it, that another woman was forced to stand for maybe 12 hours in a holding cell, if you will, at Baltimore's airport, or perhaps it was at Reagan. But then they went home and they probably tucked their children in and they had dinner. And the point of the piece was that don't think that you need goons or minions to enforce some of these things. All you need are regular people who are saying, "Well, I'm just doing my job." And that was the excuse of certain trials that went on in the 1940s. We're obviously nowhere near that, but that's all it takes. And to Colin's point, the Supreme Court doesn't have a mechanism for enforcement other than local law enforcement. And if they don't necessarily agree, then we're going down a path that we're not familiar with.
Which is why, you know, when we talked with George Jepson, the Attorney General of the state of Connecticut yesterday, he said this state is joining with a lot of other states to try to uphold this temporary suspension of the travel ban. He talked to WNPR's Harry Jones about this because he said that this is really harming Connecticut residents and businesses.
We've reached out to businesses. We've reached out to universities and healthcare institutions. And we have identified well over 100 people who would be affected and that their travel plans could be disrupted.
So, Susan, it looks as though, you know, the state of Connecticut, many other states are trying to figure out where they fit into all this. Many making the argument, this is going to be bad for businesses, this is going to be bad for people. We're expecting people to come here on work visas. We're expecting students to come here and study, students who are sometimes tied to big university grants. This is big business, aside from all of the human rights stuff that Max just talked about.
And that argument is very valid, but it doesn't seem to sway the Trump administration one bit, which is amazing for an administration that claims to be so pro-business. But yeah, that's a real issue, because what's going to happen if this law is up, if this executive order is upheld, what then? What do we do? Is this going to be a situation where there's going to be selective enforcement? Are we going to say, is the nullification idea going to come back again? The idea that states can simply not follow a federal law. This is heading us down a road to a serious crisis.
So, yeah, maybe the connective tissue here is that this immigration ban affects people who have spent their lives or substantial portions of their lives trying to figure out certain things and make certain things work. So if you're in the tech business and suddenly there's this monkey wrench, you know, can your employee from one of these countries or one of the countries that's likely to be affected or added to the list in the future, can that person go home and visit his family? Can this other person that you thought you were going to hire even get over here at all? You know, these kinds of things are very disruptive to the business environment. And then, you know, on the other side, and go back to what Max was talking about, our refugee process is the most watertight, severe refugee process in the world. It is unbelievably strict. It's 12 to 18 months minimum of screening by 7 to 8 different law enforcement or homeland security organizations. There's biometric scanning. There's fingerprinting. You should pray that a Syrian refugee moves in next to you or moves in downstairs. Those will be the most fly-specked people in the country right now. And there was this pretense that it's like this shoddy thing that needs to be looked at because we don't really know whether it works or not. And I mean, there's just no evidence to support that. And there were This American Life did a great episode this week, and they talked, among other things, about the people who do this, who make these incredibly difficult calls, who research these people for 18 months and try to figure out, you know, can we let this person in? They cried. They left work at the end of the day. They all went out and they cried because they understood the complexity of this situation in a way that the president and Steve Bannon did not.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the complexity of education at the federal level and also at the state level. I'll talk a bit about the state budget. Maybe later on in the program, we'll talk a bit about whether hockey's coming back to Connecticut. I don't know. Nate Silver's writing about it, so maybe there's something there. Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. We'll be right back in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking today with Max Reese, political reporter at NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow, who's a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who's got a show coming up today. What's happening on your show today, Colin?
Well, it seems like all we talk about these days, even during our pledge drive, is the role of the press in the new America. We're going to do our own version of that show today. Lewis Wallace, who's in the center of the storm over at Marketplace, he's the person who was fired for expressing his opinions at Marketplace. He'll be part of the show. Matt Taibbi, famous crusading journalist from Rolling Stone, he's part of the show. Virginia Heffernan, one of the hosts of the suddenly indispensable podcast, Trumpcast, is on the show. And there's also a little round table among me and the three producers of the show about how we understand and define our particular mission in this news environment.
That is a fascinating program coming up today on the Colin McEnroe Show. I am hosting an event that's not too dissimilar from that as we talk with media leaders from all across the state for an in-studio town hall. That's happening tomorrow, February 9th. Doors are opening at 6:30 p.m. There's more information on our website, WMPR.org. I will just make this caveat that for everything I see from Storm Team, what do you call it over there at NBC, Max? It's a storm center.
We are the first alert weather station.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cross-brand you.
But we also have the first alert one. okay. which is the Jeep, and we have the AT1 all-terrain one, which is the frightening-looking pickup truck
that
haunts your dreams.
What the first alert people over at NBC tell me that there might be quite a bit of snow tomorrow afternoon, so we may have to postpone that event. Stay tuned to WMPR.org, but it will be an interesting conversation whenever we have it. Before we move to some state stuff, Betsy DeVos nominated and then eventually confirmed after quite some consternation from the left. Mike Pence, the vice president, breaks the tie. It's one of the first times we've seen one of these 50-50 splits where you actually have to have Mike Pence sit in there and break the tie. New York students walked out after they heard about this. Hundreds of students walked out of classrooms. Colin, the Betsy DeVos nomination, interesting from a standpoint of here's a Republican Party that has talked quite openly about wanting to get rid of an education department, and now we have somebody without a lot of education experience heading it up.
Right. So once again, to this idea of burn the institutions to the ground, you've got an EPA nominee who is the most famous opponent of the EPA, and you've got, but at least has a record of public service. You've got an education nominee who, like Donald Trump and like many other people in this cabinet, has no record of public service whatsoever. And you know, what tends to go with that is not much understanding of how government works. I mean, Ronald Reagan didn't like government, but his cabinet nominees had much, much, much more government experience, and they at least understood how to play around with and tinker with government in interesting ways. These people tend to sort of think all or nothing. And Betsy DeVos was so unresponsive during the puny little confirmation hearing that it's very difficult to predict what her behavior is going to be. She doesn't seem to know that much stuff, which tends to put you at the mercy of your longtime professional staff who's been doing this stuff for a long time. And if you don't understand how the department works, it's difficult to rule by fiat and just say, all right, well, I'm going to undo everything. I mean, in fact, that's a Gordian knot that needs to be untied pretty carefully by a lot of people who know what they're doing. So it could be a slow process for her.
Yeah, it could be one of two things. She could be in there as sort of a bomb thrower to sort of tear everything down and put in her own vision of what education, public education, should be, which would likely involve more homeschooling and vouchers and things like that. Or it might be that she is completely inept. And that's, I think, something we're going to see from a lot of this administration. Are they going to just wreck everything, or are they going to just kind of flounder about?
I think there was a great prediction I heard yesterday where we talked about how under Arnie Duncan, we got Race to the Top and we got the Common Core explosion in some parts of the country, and how the prediction was on the right, you might get something similar because they can't compel states to do anything, but they can urge them to do things with holding money out. So what if they were to do things like those vouchers, coming up with state level ideas where you partner with business? There will more than likely be tax credits attached to these things for corporations for their write-offs. So I think we're kind of going to see the inverse of what we saw under Obama.
Just one quick thing. One thing that I do think is kind of an interesting bellwether moment here is, I mean, one of the reasons there were Republican defections and Mike Pence had to break that tie is because teacher unions are still a very politically powerful force in America. There are some Republican senators who may have had principled problems with Betsy, but they also probably had some significant concerns about what would happen in their upcoming reelection campaigns. And this might be one of the first times you're kind of seeing that just simply hewing to the Trump doctrine and the Trump preferences may be politically unappetizing for certain Republican senators and congresspersons.
Well, let me just turn quickly to the state budget that's going to be unveiled today. So Governor Malloy has a big task ahead of him. He's putting out a budget that's got to take care of about a $1.7 billion deficit. But of course, in future years, that deficit is even bigger. There's talk about taxes, tax increases not necessarily being off the table for the first time in a long time. We'll talk about this a bit more after our break. But Susan, one of the things that's on the agenda really is a change to the education formula, a real change to the way cities and towns get money for, well, education.
Right. And so the way that they used to do it, I believe it was tied to school lunches and whoever got free school lunches. And now they're trying to find a better metric to actually determine which towns need more money than others. So, yeah, this formula is going to change. And I think we're going to see a lot of the wealthier towns like your Simsbury's, your Greenwich's, Glastonbury's, that sort of thing, losing a bit of state money. And more money will go towards schools in Hartford and Waterbury and Bridgeport. Other things that may happen relating to education, though, there's a plan possibly to offload part of the teacher retirement fund to the towns. And this, I think, is part of a larger strategy in this budget to offload a lot of costs to the towns. So you're probably going to see your property taxes go up if this comes to fruition. There also is a plan, of course, to raise some sales taxes in towns, but we'll see if that actually happens.
And 2 points on that. I think one thing that you can't forget is that the state does have a lawsuit, a ruling hanging over it from a state judge in September that in no uncertain terms said this state is unconstitutionally keeping children from getting an equal education, whether you live in a Glastonbury, a Simsbury, or a Bridgeport or a Hartford. And the governor has said this is his response to it. This is what he thinks will work. But secondly, I also think that this is the governor trying to come up with a strategy to maybe fight with cities and towns, but maybe even allow cities and towns to come up with their own ideas. And I only say that, and don't think I'm trying to give more credit here than credit is due, but I'm only saying that because he's kind of saying, let's burn the whole thing down. But he also said about a week
and a half. We've heard that already today.
Yeah. But we also heard him say a week and a half ago he wanted to ease mandates on cities and towns. So if those cities and towns can come up with their own ways to perhaps fund, I'm not calling it county, I'm not calling it anything other than perhaps revenue that gets tossed around a little bit, but he's saying, this is what I want to do, and it will hurt you really bad. So maybe you should come up with something that won't hurt you as bad.
But taxing authority, all that goes to the legislature. I mean, that has to be approved by a legislature, Colin, that I don't know is necessarily going to want to play some of the same games that the governor's talking about here.
Right. In some ways, the conversation we're having right now is a little bit futile because, in fact, this is really kind of an opening bid and there's a long process that's going to unfold here. But I think, you know, there is sort of a couple of messages here coming from Malloy. One of them is, you know what? Yeah, we're going to have to make a lot of this stuff a lot more means tested than we have already. Sounds a little bit like Groundhog Day. Not the first time it's been discussed that the poorer towns should be getting more of the money. But, you know, maybe he means it a little bit more. The bucket has a bigger hole in it right now. And there's just less money to play around with. So maybe it makes sense to really target where that money goes. But it seems to be accompanied by an understanding that every time you do something to the towns, property taxes go up. It's not as though anybody has a whole bunch of money that they're not using or not spending right now. Now, that seems to be there in his rhetoric somehow. One fairly revolutionary thing is talking about letting towns tax the property taxes of hospitals, which is, well, that'll be a fight.
It's always fun when he goes back after the hospitals.
Hello, lobbyists.
Here we go with the hospitals again. We're talking today in the Wheelhouse about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, and Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. We're going to be back after this break, but first I'm going to go to some colleagues who are going to tell you why you should support with whatever little money you have right now WNPR and all the great things that you hear on public radio. Please support this radio station. It's where you can hear real conversation about real news. We'll be right back. It's The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Susan Bigelow, columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Max Reese, political reporter at NBC Connecticut. It is budget day, as we were talking about just before the break. The governor set to unveil his budget. Now, Max, we have a very interesting situation in the state Senate where there's a divide there, an even split, a little new power-sharing arrangement. I guess I'm wondering how you feel this budget, whatever the governor does put forward today, is going to be met by a new type of legislature in which Republicans have a lot more control than they used to.
I think there's a bit of a talking out of both sides of their mouth coming from Democrats last week. And I say that because they're the ones saying that Republicans don't want to lead. They don't want to do this. They don't want to do that. And, you know, I will say the Republicans were a little bit late coming out with their opposition to the pension spreading out the refinancing. However, I think Democrats made it very clear they're willing to use Nancy Wyman every time. And I think that they think that that gives them kind of a carte blanche to keep going, even on something like the budget. However, if they do that, then that sets them up in a year and a half to own everything, even though their strategy a month and a half ago was to figure out a way for Republicans to own something because they had to have their fingerprints on it. But if they use Nancy Wyman, lieutenant governor, then it's only their fingerprints.
Could you stop saying use Nancy Wyman? That's like release the Kraken.
It comes with 8-inch stilettos.
And can be kind of dangerous.
Yes. But of course, there's also the problem that Democrats may have that there are some Democrats that don't
Absolutely.
Always vote with them. There's Joan Hartley.
Paul Doyle.
Yeah. So if those senators who are a little more fiscally conservative can go with the Republicans for one or two votes, then that takes Nancy Wyman right out of play, and it changes things dramatically.
Well, what do you see coming up in this session, Susan? Because so much of it is going to be focused around trying to solve these gargantuan budget deficits. We're going to see cuts to state government services once again. That's just unquestioned. It is likely we'll see some sort of revenue enhancements, whether in the form of traditional good old taxes or something that's shifted around. What do you think is going to happen over the course of these next couple months, even after the governor puts out his plan?
I think it's going to be just torture. And it's going to be something that's going to last for a long time. We could find ourselves going well past the end of the session date again. I don't see anybody coming up with permanent fixes, though. This is something that's happened the past however many budget cycles, where we cut government, we make all these deals, we demand concessions from the unions, and then we wind up with another massive deficit a year later. And I don't see that they're really not fixing it. It's not fixed. And what's being proposed now, it's still not going to fix it. It doesn't fix the massive revenue problems that we have. It doesn't fix the pension problems that we have. I don't think that there's any hope that that's going to be radically reformed anytime soon. So we're still in this hole, and we're still not going to get out of it. So I think we're going to end up with this kind of duct tape together, quick fixes that do balance the books, but that make things pretty nasty for whoever's next.
So last week while you were off, I invented a new adjective for my growing sense that I agree with Len Fasano, the Senate Republican leader, and that is Fasanovian. I feel that I am increasingly Fasanovian.
You look like a Fasanova.
Yeah, I feel very Fasanovian. So, I mean, look, the central argument or the bedrock argument that's going to take place is going to be the Republicans saying state employees in one way or another have to eat some of this problem. They have to eat more of it than they have in the past. And a lot of it depends on how they frame that or whether they can sort of make it a conversation as opposed. One of the things that the Republicans typically do is they put out their own budget, which I think is a big waste of time because it assumes that lots of people like to read lots of budgets, which I think is not true. You know, whereas if you can make
I'll
this.
Second that.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, you and Keith Banoff, and that's about it.
Exactly.
You know, but if they can make this a really interesting conversation, and maybe not a confrontational one either, but just sort of say maybe if it's possible that Malloy, Democratic leadership, and Republican leadership could sit down and say, really, what's something we could all live with and bring out there that meaningfully addresses some of these problems, isn't the kind of quick fix that Susan was just talking about, but in a long-term way does this without completely stressing out and making total enemies out of the state employee system. I know this is a very utopian, Pollyanna-ish vision, but that's the only good outcome, right, is they really take the negotiation process seriously on both sides as opposed to grandstanding.
I think they will take it seriously. I think Democrats will as well, but I also think that we're going to reach a point in this session that reached straight up juvenile and childish, where I think that by the end, when we have a budget, you're going to have, let's say it does have employee concessions, let's say it does in the hundreds of millions, because that's what the number would have to be. The Republicans will say, that's because of us. We did that. That's all us. Oh, but those taxes, no, that's the Democrats' fault. The Democrats are going to say, no, we all did this. We did this because we're so awesome. And it's just going to sound outright ridiculous when it's happening. But we're all going to cover it. It's going to keep going. And then probably taxpayers are going to be ones who end up really taking the hit.
I have to ask you, Susan, about another one of the struggles, of course, as we're looking for money to just balance the books. The governor's been talking for years about how we're going to fix our transportation infrastructure. Just yesterday, as a matter of fact, we had another one of these incidents where a bridge that's supposed to open and then close for Metro North, like, stayed open. And so it causes massive traffic delays. This is down in Cost-Cobb. We've got failing bridges. We've got failing roads. And we've got no transportation lockbox, something that the governor's been pushing for a long time, so that we can have a special transportation fund where money actually goes to, you know, transportation problems.
Yeah. Somehow it seems like this idea of the transportation lockbox has kind of died. I mean, there are a ton of people proposing it as a bill, as a constitutional amendment this time around, but I don't see any movement behind that. No one seems interested this time, which is too bad because there needs to be something like that to keep the legislature from using transportation dollars for the general fund. I have heard a couple people talking about tolls again. This is becoming, I think, more of a possibility as we see how well the system works in Massachusetts with the electronic tolls. There's no toll booths anymore on the Mass Pike. This actually works really well, and it's very easy for people to use. So if we put a bunch of these things down on, say, 95 in Fairfield County, which is easy for me to say because I don't go there. But we could also put them on 84 in Hartford and 91, the most heavily trafficked parts of the state. That would raise a lot of revenue. I don't know if the will is there, but I have heard people talking about it.
I will say I just hosted a forum, Colin, last week at the state capitol, or the week before, with Bob Duff and Kevin Witkos, a Democratic and Republican leader, talking about what's coming up. I floated the idea of tolls past them. It doesn't seem like something that they care about talking about at all, even a little bit.
I really hate it when you name drop like that. Oh, I talked to Bob Duff. You know, I mean, I understand. You travel with a pretty fast crowd. But, yeah, so, I mean, I do think, look, tolls are worth talking about.
Bob Duff and Kevin Witkos.
I don't know. I'm jelly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was talking with Beyonce and Jay-Z at the Capitol last week.
Does Beyonce have a toll plan?
And neither one of them really have any appetite for overhead tolls.
She and Jay-Z do have a lockbox, however. So, yeah, I mean, look, we could talk about tolls, and we can talk about maybe even hiking up the gas tax a little bit and stuff like that, but not in this fluid situation that we're describing here right now. There's no particular guarantee that the money goes anywhere. And as your close personal friend Bob Duff pointed out, you know, without any kind of understanding what the federal strategy is too, it's kind of hard to sort of say, okay, here's the money we have to fix bridges that stay open when they're supposed to close and stuff like that. If, in fact, you don't have any way of accounting for that money at the state level and you're not sure what the feds are coming up with either.
And something that can't be, I'll say this quickly, something that can't be forgotten is that if a infrastructure bill were to come out of Congress, it's almost guaranteed it would come with the strings attached for tolls to pay for part of it, just because that's the way those work with matching. So even if it comes out, you would have a fight between Republicans here in Connecticut and their president saying, well, we don't want tolls, but he says we need to have a plan with tolls, and who knows what happens.
It's the only state up here that doesn't have any tolls. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that the tolls work in an awful lot of places,
right. Yes.
And we've got a lot of people coming through the state whose money we could capture if indeed we had some tolls. But anyway, other money that we probably don't have that the governor's talked about spending is a big renovation for the Excel Center in Hartford. Of course, you know, this is a place where the UConn basketball team plays. You get concerts every now and again. It used to have a professional hockey team. Now, Susan, this is sort of tied up in a conversation about whether this state is going to make another push to get professional hockey back here.
Right. And so this is all because of the New York Islanders situation down in Brooklyn, which is where they actually play now. They don't play in Nassau County anymore. They play in the Barclays Center, which is a hideous building for hockey because it was made for basketball. It's made for the Brooklyn Nets. And so to put a hockey rink in there, a hockey rink is much larger than a basketball court, they had to take out a bunch of seats. There's obstructed views where you can't actually see one of the goals, which is bad. And the attendance is miserable. Not surprisingly, and people in Brooklyn not excited by hockey, surprise. But the building at this point, the actual Barclays Center, is thinking about kicking them out because they're not profitable. So in comes Hartford and Mayor Bronin and Governor Malloy saying, hey, we've got this great arena here. Whaler's merchandise is selling really well. Wouldn't this be a great deal? Well, would it? I don't know. This seems like something that is almost absurd to think about, that a team would move out of the largest media market in the country to here.
But to be fair, the largest media market in the country where people can't actually watch the game inside the arena. I mean, that is a problem, really, when you have seats that don't work for watching the sport being played.
That is a problem. But I think what's going to happen instead, there's this plan being bandied about to actually move them to Queens, to near where Citi Field is. I don't know. But I don't see them coming here. If they were going to move, there's other places where they could go instead. So this just seems like a weird thing to be. To try to be chasing.
Look, Staten Island. Island's right in the name, Max.
I think that's right there. There's so much to unpack here. I just, first of all, it was on a Friday, not a slow news day, but it was the shiny object on the Friday. Hockey, it's going to happen, maybe, sort of. Yeah. And also $250 million to redo the Excel Center. If that doesn't scream of tone deafness when it comes to the budget, I don't know what else would. We're broke. We have a billion and a half deficit. We're talking about more money.
But I just want to make sure, and I was conflating the two because it's part of the conversation. The $250 million isn't about just spending it to get a hockey team.
No, right.
It's because if we're going to have a big-time arena in Hartford, the governor and a lot of other people are saying you can't really make it work if you don't do some upgrades.
You have to. You obviously have to. But then the question is do you shift that money into the capital budget or do you put it somewhere else? And I think that'll be, even though those are two different sides of the budget, that will lead to a gigantic fight in the General Assembly.
So, yeah, I mean, the Civic Center or the Excel Center is one of those things where it's crazy to spend that money on it. It's also crazy not to spend money on fixing it up. So that is not a very helpful analysis on my part. But it's really true, right? And it's right now, you could maybe attract cockfighting, but anything more upscale than that, it's not in good enough shape, really, to handle, the kinds of things that you would want to bring in there to make Hartford a thriving and vibrant city. So there's that argument. I'm also a little troubled, but sports is the only place where you can seriously say, as a public official, well, if we spent $250 million, this other thing might happen, maybe. Might happen. It's so far-fetched. The Islanders, by the way, are saying, oh, well, we love it in Brooklyn, blah, blah, blah. Of course, what are they going to say if they say, we can't wait to get out of here? What little fan base they have completely walks away. So you can't really go by what they say. I don't know what the right answer is. I do think, there steps have to be taken to make Hartford a thriving, plausible capital city. It's just part of having a functioning state. I'm also a little, wary of these sports arguments, particularly when they just seem so thinly constructed.
Yeah, and the business of sports, especially at the major league level these days, what the owners really want is they want a gigantic, big, shiny new arena that they can show to everybody, and they want the government to pay for it entirely. There's a stadium in Hartford right now that's kind of going through the same thing. But yeah, so the idea that the Islanders would come here if we're just pushing some renovations of a 40-year-old building at them, it's not shiny enough. There are other places. It's not. If they are looking for that, there's Quebec City, which actually did build a new arena, hoping to lure an NHL team.
And to your point earlier, John, Nate Silver, he teased it out there bigger than anybody. Look, Hartford has the population base to support it. The question is whether people would actually purchase the season tickets and actually support a team. And we're also still talking about something that would be 2 or 3 years away with any renovations.
Yeah, right now, and he's written this, a lot of other people have said it, it's the largest market in America that doesn't have any of the big four professional sports teams. So yeah. It seems as though it could work, but there's so much that goes into it. I think Max Susan's point is exactly right. This isn't a brand new arena that would attract people. This is an old arena that, as Colin said, might attract cockfighting. Well, we'll have to sort of leave
really
it there.
I mean the Philippines kind, the really good kind.
Oh, the
of
good
cockfighting.
Kind.
Good
okay.
cockfighting.
Yeah,
not the bad kind.
So the really
classy
end.
Stuff.
The top
okay.
end of cockfighting.
Okay.
I want to thank Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We're going to send it into some colleagues who are going to tell you why you should support everything on WNPR. I want to thank our technical producer, Kion Wolf. Thanks so much to Lydia Brown and Betsy Kaplan and Jeff Tyson for helping with today's show and sending out some love and some light to the family of Katie Solarski, our executive producer. This is The Wheelhouse.